The University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, by two-way transatlantic radio telephone, the Roundtable presents a special discussion from London and Washington of how effective is the North Atlantic Alliance. Taking part in today's transcribed program are two members of the British Parliament, Walter Elliott, conservative, and Kenneth Younger, laborite. And from Washington, Senator Carl E. Munt of South Dakota and James B. Reston, Washington correspondent of the New York Times. Robert McKenzie speaks from London in introducing today's guests, and our Washington moderator is Malcolm Sharp of the Law School of the University of Chicago. From London, we present Mr. McKenzie.
This is Robert McKenzie speaking from a BBC studio in London. The BBC's London Forum is very pleased indeed to join forces again with the University of Chicago Roundtable to bring you today a discussion of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, its present problems, and its future. There are two United States members of our panel and two British members of our panel, and I'm going to begin by calling in Malcolm Sharp in Washington to introduce the American side of the panel. Hello, Malcolm Sharp.
Hello, Robert McKenzie. We are here in Washington with Senator Carl Munt of South Dakota and Mr. James Reston, Washington correspondent for the New York Times, both of them familiar with current European developments and very alert to the problems that are now involved. You wish to introduce your people from London, don't you now?
Yes, certainly. Well, I have with me in the studio here in London, Right Honourable Walter Elliott, Conservative MP for a constituency in Clydeside, Scotland, formerly Minister of Agriculture and at one time Secretary for Scotland, and a frequent British delegate to the League of Nations in the mid-war years. Also, I have the Right Honourable Kenneth Younger, a Labour MP for an East Coast port, formerly Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. Some of you on the American side may know of him as a British delegate to the San Francisco Conference on the Japanese Peace Treaty and a frequent visitor to Lake Success, again with British delegations. Well, I think, Malcolm Sharp, we might begin over here by taking a look at the question, is NATO doing its job of work with regard to defense adequately? In other words, do we feel safe over on this side? How about it, Kenneth Younger?
Well, I think it's perhaps going a bit far to say we feel safe as yet. But it's undoubtedly true that in recent months, the confidence of Western Europe and of Britain has risen very considerably. Some of you may remember that General Eisenhower said less than 2 months ago that although, of course, he wasn't satisfied, he thought that his forces were now strong enough to create a stalemate, though expensively and uneasily. Well, that's not satisfactory, of course, but it's a great deal better than it was when he arrived in Europe still less than a year ago. And I think we should remember it's a short time that this has been going, even less than 3 years from the time the treaty was signed, and that during that time, the building up of these forces has been greatly hindered by diversions to other theatres. Would you add anything to that, Walter Elliott?
I think I'd agree with Kenneth Younger. While we don't feel safe, we feel safer. And I think the test of it is that people who are outside this organization are anxious to get into it. That's always the test of a good club if people want to join it. Now, both Greece and Turkey have shown a strong inclination to be associated with this. And certainly one of them, at least, has a long and very exposed frontier and is liable to all sorts of danger. Therefore, I think you may say that it is doing a good job now. And it is very astonishing what progress has been made in a short time.
Well, there you have it, Malcolm Sharp. How do your people feel about it?
Carmont, what do you think about this?
Well, I think I would answer the question the same way as our British colleagues. Progress has been made, but the progress has not been enough, and it has not been fast enough. And consequently, we have to look at the situation as it is. So if I were to say, do you feel completely safe? I would have to say no. Like the British colleagues, of course, we feel safer from realizing that some progress has been made in establishing armaments over in your area.
James Reston, the general tone here seems happy, if not complacent. Can't you add a...
Well, I would like to raise this question, if I may. I can remember in the days of the 30s, when I was a correspondent on your side of the water, that every American who was there in that time was always told that right after the last war, if we had only come in, by which they meant into some political association with our British friends and the others on the continent, that we should not have had either the First World War or the Second World War. In other words, they were saying, I think, to me at that time that they thought that the thing that deterred war was the political commitment. And at the present time, it seems to me that we are talking about this purely in terms of divisions. And I'm wondering if we can ever really feel safe in terms of military divisions, or whether the security does not rest upon the political commitment.
What sort of political commitment do you have in mind there?
Well, I mean the fact that the United States has said after this war, as it certainly did not after the first war, that any aggressor that was planning any attack upon the west of Europe, or roughly upon the entire NATO organization or area, would find the United States opposed to that aggressor, that if such a commitment were given, there would be no attack. Now, that commitment clearly has been given by the United States in the NATO treaty. That is my point.
Walter Elliott?
Yes, but I think without something to back it, the commitments really wouldn't, the political commitments really wouldn't amount to very much. I'm reminded of the story of the old Quaker who saw the accident, and somebody said, are you very sorry for these people? He said, friend, I am sorry £5. How much are these sorry? And I think that the fact, for instance, that an American admiral has been appointed as head of the Atlantic Command, it's a very important political fact, but it's still more important that he should have something to command. And I think we've got to begin on the basis of divisions and then move on to how these divisions are to be controlled.
Kenneth Younger?
Well, I wouldn't at all dissent from what James Weston has said, but I would just add the one military point that in addition to the political commitment, we do attach importance to Americans being there on the spot before a war, so that they would be there at the start and not be coming in after a certain time lag. We're not quite sure in modern conditions how much of a time lag one could afford.
But I just wanted to say this, Kenneth, that I think, as you know, I certainly agree that we must have something to back up the political commitment. The thing that disturbs me is this idea of safety. I'm wondering if this generation can ever really feel safe, if we can ever really place upon the continent the number of divisions that would be absolutely necessary to guarantee our safety against the overwhelming land power of the Soviet Union.
Kenneth Younger?
Yes, well, I do entirely agree with that. And I think the major safety factor certainly is the knowledge that the United States would weigh in. But we feel sure of that if we see some Americans over this side in times of peace as well.
Paramount, you will have to vote on appropriations and decisive bits of legislation. Are you satisfied with the way things are going?
No, I don't believe I can say that I'm satisfied. I would like to comment, first of all, on the repeated emphasis of both of our British colleagues about the desire to have some Americans in being in Europe and in uniform, because a great many of our people in this country are pretty much disturbed about the fact that it seems that about the only Americans in being in any numbers in uniform at the moment are Americans. And I think that if they're going to have people in uniform over there, true, America can contribute its part, but that there should be a great deal more effort made by the people closer to the immediate danger zone to keep their number of people there. That's one of the things that is causing some concern over here, and one thing which disturbs us also from the standpoint of the matter of appropriation.
I shouldn't deny at all that there could be other people there besides Americans, but I do not think either of us said that I hope we didn't put too much emphasis on the fact of Americans. I would put just as much emphasis on the fact of Britisher, in fact of Scotchmen. Until we get the Scotch divisions over there, I do not think Europe will feel completely safe. But after all, we've got a good, big, heavy commitment there now, and that commitment is growing. I think that the effort we are putting out on rearmament is straining every nerve just now. Look at the cut we just recently suffered in our meat rations, for instance. We are putting a tremendous weight of our financial, our economic, and our manpower into just this very question of having a force ready to go in, and a good deal of it actually on the spot. As for the force in Britain, remember that it can get to Europe in 20 minutes.
Well, I entirely agree with what my colleague Walter Elliot has said, I think he's correct, that Britain has never had so many troops overseas, including Europe, in peacetime as she has at the present time. And I would just like to revert to one point I mentioned, this question of the diversion to other theatres. We're anxious to make our biggest possible contribution to Europe, but there has been diversion of French and British divisions, which, as given by Mr. Churchill recently, amount to about 16 divisions, to the Far Eastern Theatre and to Asia generally. All those, of course, could have been in Europe if they hadn't been elsewhere. That's one of the reasons we're so very keen not to increase commitments in that hemisphere.
NATO is extending, in effect, into the Middle East and the Far East. Do you think this is a desirable thing, James Erskine?
Well, I don't think that was what Mr. Younger was suggesting. I think he was merely pointing out that while they were making a certain contribution to NATO, they were also making a large contribution elsewhere. But that does raise in my mind this question. Would it not be very useful to the understanding on both sides of the Atlantic if there were some overall world strategy for the world board, you might call it, which would look at the requirements of our military personnel all over the world instead of merely partially for Korea and partially for NATO. The thought I have in mind there is that at the present time, I think there's little realization on this side of the water as to what your commitments over there are. In Malaya and places such as that. Whereas on your side, there seems to be also some little understanding of what our commitments are in Korea and elsewhere.
What do you think of this suggestion, Walter Elliot?
I think there's a great deal of truth in it. I think it's one of the reasons why we all on this side welcomed the visit of Mr. Churchill to the other side of the Atlantic so that they could review the whole situation and not merely one or the other angle of it. And if we could, of course, extend that to a really top-level discussion with the chiefs of the Soviet Union as well, there might be a chance of getting rid of all these difficulties. But I think there's a good old French proverb that the best is the enemy of the good. Let us make sure that we do understand and work the bits that can be made to work. Now, we think NATO can be made to work. And apart from that, I think that a review by the chief politician would probably be better and more effective than a review by a military board. I don't know if the situation is ripe for a military board to review world strategy in the sense that has just been mentioned.
Coming back from the world as a whole, this question raises the problem of European unification, the European army. Paramount, what are your views on that?
That's just what I was going to revert to, Mr. Sharp. We seem to agree that from the standpoint of putting enough men in Europe to rely solely upon manpower as a factor of safety against the almost unlimited manpower of Russia would never seem to give us a very secure position. It also seems to hold that the cost of maintaining an army of that kind is rather prohibitive to the British, as our British cousins have indicated, and it certainly is becoming definitely prohibitive over here. And as we face up to the facts of life and the fiscal budget now confronting us in Congress, the demands we hear from the folks back home and from both sides of the aisle are all in the direction of economy. So I think that we should make more of the factor of organization. I think if we could bring about something which we refer to over here loosely as a United States of Europe, which perhaps has to move in the direction of an economic and political union growing by degrees, that would increase confidence certainly on this side and I believe on that side of the ocean. And surely it would be much easier for American taxpayers to contribute to a United States of Europe bound together politically and not divided by a lot of little boundary lines and differences of currency and tariff restrictions, much more easy for us to encourage a continuing appropriation for that type of program than when we have to deal with 12 countries, each more or less strictly autonomous and separate from the other.
Well, Kenneth Younger, what do you feel is the British reaction to this sort of suggestion?
Well, I don't think that we in Britain have ever wished to oppose the idea that there should be increasing unity in Europe. I think that the last speaker referred to doing it gradually, and we would certainly think that it's a thing that could only come gradually. Where there's been some misunderstanding, I think in the United States, isn't the idea that Britain is just as much a part of Europe as all the other European states. That, of course, does overlook the fact that we have essentially always been a world power, that our Commonwealth is scattered all around the world, and that we couldn't afford to sink our identity completely in purely European institutions. Moreover, as far as the defence side is concerned, we have never felt in modern conditions that a purely European combination would be enough. I doubt whether you would get these very great economies, which the last speaker referred to, at any rate very quickly, simply by the fact of adding all these European nations together. It's a long-term problem, but I don't think the defence problem could wait for it.
Now, Kenneth Younger is a Labour MP. Let's see if the Conservatives agree with this approach. Walter Elliott?
Well, I think on this, our Conservative view is very similar to the view that Kenneth Younger has just been stating. But we go a little further. We're naturally cautious people, Conservative, and we want to be sure that if we make a united army, the right wing isn't going to fight the left wing of it. It's all very well to say, let us have a United States of Europe politically bound together. But unless you have them spiritually bound together a little more than they are just now, there's no security at all that this army is going to fight as one. And that is, I think, the point that's a little overlooked on the other side. Merely to put the European states into a room and say, you are now the Federated States, the United States of Europe, isn't going to make sure that when the army goes into action, half of it isn't going to march over to the other side. We feel that we're all right with the NATO power because they are our blood brothers. They think the same way, they feel the same way, they talk the same way in many cases. But there are wide and deep differences on the continent, which you can't hurry. You can't hurry the solution, though.
There's skeptics on this side, too, about this proposal, James Reston.
Well, I wouldn't include myself among the skeptics particularly, but I would raise this question as to whether it is not a higher and more practical ideal to merely to implement the objectives of the North Atlantic Treaty. That is to say, to work toward closer organization within the entire Atlantic, rather than merely perhaps a divisive, smaller association of the European nations within the Atlantic community.
Paramount, I'd like to bring into court as a witness at this stage a very eminent citizen of world renown, and that's General Eisenhower, who has a statement in the issue of U.S. News and World Report, which came out here in Washington today. He makes this rather definite statement, with which I certainly find myself in complete agreement. He says there must be progress toward the unification of Western Europe if the objective of permanent security and peace in the Western world is to be realized. Going on in his article, he talks about the importance of holding at least a constitutional convention to explore the possibility of bringing about that kind of political unity. And I think the time is here when our good friends in Britain should decide, and it's a decision which they should make, whether they would want to be a part of such a political union in Western Europe if it can develop, or if they prefer to be out of it. But until that first decision is made, I suppose it's difficult for the rest of the countries of Europe to determine who even to call in to the Constitutional Convention. I think either with or without Britain in it, there is much good to come from what we might loosely refer to as the United States of Europe. And certainly the only way to begin is to begin.
Well, I think, if I may say so, that in the same statement, General Eisenhower did make it clear that he appreciated Britain couldn't be on the same footing as the European powers. He used the phrase progress towards unification. I think we can probably all agree with that, and I know there are very many people in Europe who would. The trouble really is whether you mean by unification some kind of a tight federal organization or something a good deal looser.
Yes, because I think sometimes we're blinded a little by looking at maps and seeing a piece of land called Europe. There, a friend of mine who'd given a lot of study to this question once said, civilization is not a piece of land surrounded by water, it's a piece of water surrounded by land. The bonds across a body of water are much closer than the bonds across a piece of land. And after all, we in Europe here, or we in Britain, feel much more secure because we've got North America with us than we would if somebody said, first of all, you've got to federate Canada and the United States before anything can be done. We believe that Canada and the United States, thinking the same way, will act the same way. And the fact that there isn't at the moment a government of the whole of North America doesn't seem to us to alter the question at all.
Carmen, do you want to say?
That still leaves me in considerable doubt as to just where our British stands and stand with regard to my question, whether they prefer to be in or out of a Western European Union or a United States of Europe. I think it is very definitely a decision for Britishers to make. I think the time is here now to make it. We've been talking about it for several centuries. Winston Churchill has been a great leader in favor of a so-called United States of Europe. If we could just decide for ourselves who might belong, I think then a constitutional convention such as General Eisenhower has proposed might indicate at least how far we could go toward establishing some reasonably tight federation.
I believe
that the world has had a plethora of loosely knit organizations by now.
There are one or two other items we want to touch on in this transatlantic conversation.
Well, I think perhaps just on that last one, Sharp, we might get an answer to the question, which was put very specifically, whether or not Britain wants to be in a federation if it does get formed here in Europe. Could we have a reply on that, Walter Elliott?
Well, surely it's not possible to give a sharp and definite answer to that. You want to be in or out. After all, we in Scotland here, we regard ourselves as being part of the United Kingdom, but by no means completely blended with it. And you can't have these absolutely rigid definitions one way or the other. As was said long ago about Ireland, the Channel forbids the union and the Atlantic forbids separation. There are shades and degrees in all this. And I'm sure that you've got to regard Britain as being associated with rather than part of Europe. Why, the facts of geography show that.
Does that satisfy your side, Malcolm Sharp?
James Ashton, do you want to say something more on this?
Well, I just wanted to suggest this as a possible terminus point to this part of the discussion, that perhaps it would help the organization of NATO if all members desisted from asking other members to do things that they are not prepared to do themselves. And I couldn't, I don't want to argue with the senator from South Dakota, but I'm just wondering whether his constituents in South Dakota would look fondly upon a similar suggestion that we ourselves should be part of a United States of say, the Atlantic community.
Now that's a very fair question, Jim Reston, and I want to answer it with considerable more definiteness than I've been able to get from our British cousins to the questions I've asked them. The United States definitely does not want to be part of the United States of Europe. We are perfectly willing to associate ourselves with it, and would be increasingly desirous of helping to contribute to it if we could bring an end to the constant separation of little powers in Europe. And I think that it's very important we move politically as well as economically and militarily if we expect to be safe as free men against the strong power of the communists.
One question that I think we must touch on is the economic aspects of NATO. We are told that the burden of the expense of rearmament is breaking the European countries.
Malcolm Sharp, our boys are jumping to get back on that last question. I don't think we can pass by. The implication was that they dodged, and I think they'd like to one of them at least, like to comment.
Very well.
Younger. Well, I'd just like to point out what my colleague Walter Elliott said. I think Senator Munt, in expressing his views of the United States' attitude to coming fully into a federation, exactly expressed the British one. We are very glad that Europe should go as far as it feels inclined to and feels able to do, but we do not wish ourselves to come fully into it. And I think that was made clear in his Columbia speech by Mr. Eden on his recent trip to the United States. Is that definite enough for you?
That's
people?
Fine. I've been trying to get that for 10 minutes. I'm glad to have it.
Now, we are told that this burden of rearmament is breaking the European countries. We're sure that isn't true in any simple sense. They are great, strong countries still. But what is your view about that?
Walter Elliott?
Well, it's certainly a pretty heavy burden. Recent cuts in the meat ration, as I say, are one of the indications of that. We've had to cut out £170 million worth of foodstuffs from Europe, very largely because we can't balance our budget. And one of these things, one of the reasons for that, is the enormous amount of our resources that we have to put into rearmament. It is a strain.
May I just illustrate that point by pointing out the meat ration is down to 15 cents worth per person per week, which makes sense, I think, in North American terms, and it does illustrate how far the economy is strained here. Kenneth Younger, would you add something?
Well, I agree with Walter Elliott. I'd perhaps go just a little further. I think the fact that we have to accept a certain amount of United States military aid in order to carry out our program shows that we did put our sights just as high as we conceivably could and perhaps a bit further. In fact, we do know now that the target we aimed at a year ago is not going to be reached. I think we have strained ourselves very far indeed. And may I just refer back to a phrase that was used earlier on. If we are to bear this burden, then we've got to stress the factor of organization a bit more, because it's really the repercussions all over the world of the huge Western defense programs, the results of the terms of trade and so on, that have caused our economic crisis, rather than the actual number of guns and tanks that we're producing. It has an effect right through our economy, and perhaps we could put some of that right by a bit of cooperation and organization.
How about that?
Paramount, what do you say? Well, we have certainly reached a discussion now where I can sympathize with our British cousins because they discuss, very frankly, their financial strain and the difficulty of the British people to carry this defense load. That's something which I hear from American constituents just every day of my life, because our people also are feeling the impact of this great defense program, of deficit spending, of our foreign aid program, which is costing $1 billion a year, and of the consequent heavy taxes and inflationary costs. So it would seem to lead to the fact that all of us English-speaking people are going to have to find some more economical manner to meet this challenge of communism, lest in the final result, the prophecy of Lenin come true, and that is that he hoped to communize America by bankrupting it. I suppose he has the same hope for the British, too.
We have one final question, which relates to the remedy. Some of us were much impressed by Winston Churchill's advocacy of overall top-level negotiations with the Russians. Why won't that enable us to dispense with NATO? What has become of that proposal?
Well, when I was a member of the government and Winston Churchill was making that proposal from the opposition, we never thought to turn it down. What we said was we didn't think high-level meetings were much good without a good deal of preparation and without some reasonable hope that they could bear fruit. To go into high-level negotiations, if there really is no chance of agreement, I think very often tends to make the situation worse. All I would say is this. We must be ready, always, to take any chance there may be for negotiation, because none of us liked this great build-up of defense. I think we must go on revising our estimates of the danger we have to meet month by month and year by year. I'm one of those who take the view that it is permissible to be a bit more optimistic now than it was when we launched all these defense programs a year ago.
Well, I'm afraid our time is just about up now. I'd like to say from our side that we've been delighted to have this opportunity for an exchange of views with our American friends. And I know I'm speaking for both Walter Elliott and Kenneth Younger when I wish you all good luck.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's transcribed University of Chicago roundtable from London and Washington on how effective is the North Atlantic Alliance, were Walter Elliott, conservative member of Parliament, Kenneth Younger, laborite, Carl E. Mundt, Republican senator from South Dakota, and James B. Reston, Washington correspondent of the New York Times. The moderators were Robert McKenzie of the BBC and Malcolm P. Sharp of the Law School of the University of Chicago. The printed pamphlet of today's roundtable on how effective is the North Atlantic Alliance contains the full text of the discussion and special material from the North Atlantic Pact. Be sure to write to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, to secure your copy of today's pamphlet. Single copies are 10 cents in coin. A full year subscription to the roundtable pamphlet costs only $3. Enclose $3 with your order and make your subscription begin with today's program. Next week, the Roundtable presents a discussion in celebration of Abraham Lincoln's birthday. Be sure to hear next week's Roundtable discussion. Today's program originated in London, England, and Washington, D.C. The Roundtable is produced by George E. Probst and is a public service presentation of NBC.